This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antek. On our final recap episode today, before we welcome 2016, we have two international stories with the Netherlands' 8th ambassador and the former president of Switzerland. But first, a local story which broke in October. 5 years ago, the truck that DB Oak's husband was driving got into an accident. He died on the spot. But Madam D survived. Madam D subsequently filed a claim for loss of support and was awarded more than 150,000. However, the Court of Appeal in October reversed that decision because it deemed Madam D as an unlawful wife. Madam D went through a Chinese customary ceremony but did not register the marriage with her husband.
Today, we have family lawyer Vicky Alahakon in the studio with me. So when you read about this decision then, what were your thoughts?
Well, actually, I was not quite surprised by the decision of the court, simply because we know that all marriages now have to be registered under the Law Reform Marriage and Divorce Act. But the question here is whether you link the Law Reform Act to the Civil Law Act, which is what was used in this case. So that was the issue that the court had to decide, which act is to be applied. And unfortunately, the Civil Law Act is a very old act, and that's a 1956 act, and it hasn't been amended nor repealed. And we need to actually amend all our old acts to standardize the same, especially with regard to the definitions of children, women, wives, spouses, because we have different definitions in all these acts.
Well, the definition of a registered marriage is easy to understand. You know, it's people who go to register a marriage. But when we refer to a customary marriage, what does that mean? Does it hold any legal status at all?
Well, to be honest, you find that most couples do go through customary marriages. And what do customary marriages mean? It simply means that each couple who hail from different faiths, for instance, if you're a Christian or a Hindu, or even Hindu Sikhs, they go through the customary marriages of maybe for Hindus, they tie a thali in the temple. Christians get married in church before a priest, and you also have the Sikhs getting married in the temple. So these are considered customary marriages. But what is most important in this case, which we have to stress, is that these marriages that they undergo are customary marriages, but you need to register them with the JPN, Jabatan Pendaftaran Negara.
You brought up the issue of faith. News reports stress the fact that this was a case about a non-Muslim couple. Would the implications have been different for a Muslim marriage?
Well, actually, no, because this would apply even to Muslim couples. And if you read the Islamic Law Act together with the Law Reform Act, most of the wordings in both the acts are almost identical. So if Madam D, in this case, was a Muslim woman, she would face the same fate as what any other woman would have faced in the court. So there is no distinction in this case, yeah.
When it comes to loss of dependency, who has the right to claim for that?
Under the definition of a dependent in this case, we are talking about fatal accidents. And whoever is a dependent on the deceased is entitled to a claim for damages as a dependent of the deceased. So that includes the family of the deceased. So I'm quite sure that that argument was brought up before the courts, because who is Madam D? She is a dependent of her husband or her spouse. Whereas under the Law Reform Act, if she's not registered, she's not considered a wife. That's the difference. But we try and draw a distinction between the Law Reform Act and the Civil Law Act again, because we say that as a wife, you are entitled to, say, the matrimonial assets. But we do not talk about inheriting. So here it's a question of when your spouse is dead. So would that mean that you should have registered your marriage? So different courts, different judges take a different view of it.
So In other words, the interpretation of what wife means when it comes to dependency claims, when it comes to the will and inheritance, these are things that are governed in some part by a legal document. You have to sign a registration.
To register a marriage, yes, you need to register your marriage with the JPN. But with regard to documents as such, no. In this case, in Madam D's case, for instance, her marriage was not registered, period. And because of that, she could not claim, because the courts, or even the court saw it, that she was not the legal wife to the deceased. But the mother's fathers, they can claim, because they are dependents. In this case, I believe she had no children of her own. So she was only dependent from the deceased, yeah. The father had died in the accident too, if I'm not mistaken, yes.
However, the Sessions Court, you know, it came to a different conclusion in 2011. And what would that have been based on? You know, so as you say, different courts, different judges.
Yeah.
So how would that have been awarded?
Because in the Sessions Court, they went purely under the Civil Law Act. And the Civil Law Act says that this clause for compensation and damages is meant for the benefit of the family who survived the deceased estate. So on that basis, she was awarded the sums because she would have had to prove that she was a dependent of the deceased. And on, based on that, the court would have awarded that sum.
Earlier this year, on January 7th, the Shah Alam High Court set aside the award after ruling that there was error in the finding of facts and law by the trial judge following an appeal by the insurance company. So this error, what was it exactly?
The error was simply this. Was she a legal wife to the deceased? And they brought in the Law Reform Act and they distinguished the meaning of a legal wife as opposed to a dependent to the deceased. And that is how she did not get her damages as prayed for in the Sessions Court. Yeah.
As a long-time practitioner of family law yourself,
yes.
You know, where are you persuaded that this case, you know, which precedent should it follow? Which act should it be looking at? If it were something that you would be, if it's something that you were either presiding over or something that you were arguing?
Well, on one hand, we want marriages to be registered because the whole rationale of having the Law Reform Act, which was passed in March 1982, was to actually regulate customary marriages to avoid polygamy and also for the benefit of women and children who were considered vulnerable. In fact, it was under the, if I may just read, because the rationale for having marriages registered and parties who come from different race, religion, you see, it comes under the Declaration of Human Rights, and it says that marriages shall be entered into only with the free and full consent of the intending spouses. And the family is a natural and fundamental group, unit of society, and is entitled to protection by society and state. So this is one of the rationale for registering marriages, because we used to have women who were, if you're not married, then the poor woman will have to come to court to prove that she was a wife. And this led to many issues. And it was also to register, solemnize, and with regard to inheritance too. We needed children to be registered as legal, legitimate children, things like that. However, we still have problems of illegitimate children arising simply because of this. For instance, if Madam D had a child out of this union with her husband, that child would be deemed illegitimate. So the question again is, then we fall into the inheritance laws as to whether the child is entitled to inherit, although the marriage was, because the marriage was not registered. So we do still have these issues coming up. And that is simply because the old laws of the Civil Law Act, the Married Women and Children's Act, these are all very old acts which have not been amended to standardize everything.
That was Lee Trillian speaking to family lawyer Vicky Alhakon about dependency claims in unregistered marriages. After the break, conversations with the Netherlands AIDS ambassador and the former president of Switzerland. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Chua Antik and this is our final roundup of Live and Learn interviews from 2015. Lambert Grimes is the Special Ambassador for Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the Netherlands. He's commonly dubbed the AIDS Ambassador in the media, and he shared about how the fight to eradicate HIV/AIDS begins with sexual education.
First thing is we have the lowest teenage pregnancy rate in the world. So girls get pregnant in the Netherlands at a relatively high age. The other thing is we have the lowest abortion rate in the world. Of course, they are very much related to each other. Now, how have we realized that situation? I think it's because of a cocktail or a mixture of instruments. One is sexuality education at school. Mm-hmm. I'm very much a believer of in sexuality education at a young age, which is not as some people think, that if you provide sexuality education to a person, a young person, that he or she will immediately start having sex. No, it's actually the other way around. I'm having this argument with many, many people, mm-hmm. but I really believe in education. The other part of the mixture or the cocktail of instruments is access to services and access to commodities. If you are a young person, or if you are an older person, if you are an adult, and you want to have access to contraceptives, it's important that you have access to contraceptives. In the Netherlands, it's easy to get access to contraceptives, even at a young age. Even, and I know that's a controversial issue, even without parental consent. But we have learned that it's important for young people to take their own decisions, because if we like it or if we don't like it, young people sometimes have sexual relationships even before they are married.
They do. And I'm sure you get a lot of opposition from religious groups, conservative groups. How do you engage with them?
Well, first of all, I don't have the moral authority. I really like to repeat that every time and again. What we can do is share our experience, and our experience is based on evidence. But I do respect and accept other people's religious considerations. Actually, within my ministry last year, we started a course on religion. Of course, we are a secular country and secular mm-hmm. ministry, but we want to understand why people have certain religious motivations, and what makes, how does religion have an impact on the discussion we are having at the international level? So it's good for me to understand where religion comes from. I'm religious myself, but I also know quite a few religious people who do want to have access to sexual reproductive health services. An Irish housewife whom I met 2 weeks ago, very Catholic, very religious, said, "I want to be a good Catholic person, but at the same time, I don't want to have more than 2 children. That's a very human question, isn't it?
It is.
And at the same time, she's part of a religion of the Catholic Church, which where the Pope has not yet openly
endorsed,
supported contraception. Mm-hmm. So I find it a very human question, actually. And I think there are more questions like that. Dealing with sexual abuse, dealing with abortion, dealing with premarital sexual relationships, dealing with homosexual relationships. These are all things which happen in the world, which we sometimes judge from a moral or from an ethical or from a religious perspective. But as a government official, our position is that we have to deal with them in a pragmatic way, and in also respecting people's human rights, and also looking at it from a health perspective. And that's where HIV comes in.
So do you think you've been successful in what you're doing?
In the Netherlands, I think, yes, we have been successful when it comes to young people in particular. The average age of first-time sex in the Netherlands amongst young people is relatively high. And just a small figure, but it's very interesting. Of young people who have sex for the first time in the Netherlands, 4 out of 5 would use a condom, 80%. When I told that figure to my 15-year-old daughter, she said, what about the other 20%? I was proud about the 80%, right? But she was concerned about the other 20%.
Yeah.
And that says something about the way a young person is thinking. And I'm proud about that, because at least she is sufficiently empowered or knowledgeable about the risks and the pleasures of sexual relationships. But on an average, young people don't have a sexual relationship before 70 years in the Netherlands, which is relatively high compared to many other countries.
And these are probably due to the efforts by the department and the ministry.
Yeah, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, of course, is looking particularly at countries beyond the Netherlands, but we use our experience in the Netherlands. At the same time, we're learning a lot from others. We, for instance, have a problem with still 1,100 new cases of HIV in the Netherlands.
Every year?
Every year. We are very frustrated about that.
1,100 new cases every year.
Yeah, which maybe at the international level is not so much. There are countries with much higher figures. Yeah. But still, given the fact that this is a country with a good health system and a relatively open culture about sexuality, we don't understand where those 1,100 cases come from. So we are learning a lot from other countries, other cities, Barcelona, San Francisco. Now, here in Kuala Lumpur, I'm learning a lot. I've been shown around by the Malaysian AIDS Council. We spoke to officials here in Malaysia, to other NGOs, about their the way they are addressing HIV in Malaysia. And I'm impressed, actually, by what has been done by both government and civil society. The number of new cases, what we call HIV incidents, in Malaysia has dropped sharply over the last couple of years. For instance, due to the Malaysian government's involvement in the way they deal with the people who use drugs. We call that harm reduction. Basically, not criminalizing drug use, but offering alternatives like methadone instead of heroin, and providing needle exchange facilities. Malaysia is actually quite good at that, and maybe compared to other countries in the region, really a champion. And I've learned a lot of that.
I'm sure, because we have our transmission is more towards drug uses and the exchange of needles. How have the Dutch ministries come together to achieve this? Because it's not just all about your ministry. It's got to include the school system. It's got to include the health system. How do you all be on the same page to solve a problem like this?
Yeah, sometimes we call that the polder model. It's the way in the Netherlands we like to have a consensus amongst different parties involved, that we put a lot of effort in getting all different ministries, the different levels of government, civil society together. We work a lot through civil society organizations. And taking the example of drug users or sex workers, we as a government, we think we are not the best party to reach these people. Drug users are afraid of government officials. Yes. We know that. So we work through NGOs, very of our community-based organizations, who are much more capable than we are to reach these people, to work with them. And so we provide funding, subsidy, or health advice to these community-based organizations. So in the Netherlands, we have, a good way of cooperation amongst government agencies as well as other civil society organizations.
That was Lambert Grind speaking about his role as the AIDS ambassador. Our next interview is with the former president of Switzerland, Ruth Dreyfus. Madam Dreyfus is among the 22 world leaders who comprise the Global Commission on Drug Policy. She told me about the lessons of Switzerland from the late 80s and early 90s, when drug abuse was at its highest.
Even though treatment has increased, HIV infection transmission has been brought down, but it doesn't address consumption, because consumption of cocaine, marijuana, according to the Swiss Federal Office of Public Health, has increased. So decriminalization does not address the problem of supply. What is the policy solutions to the supply side?
On the supply side,
The solution is really to regulate the market, to look for the quality of the supply, to control by the state what is entering in the market, and to avoid to let it in the black zone of economic activities. It is one of our member, Judge Louise Arbour of our Global Commission on Drug Policy, told at one of our meeting that if the people would now gather, the representative of the states would now gather, let's say in a UN building, to look how to deal with drugs, they would adopt a system like they adopted for tobacco. They would accept also systems like they exist for chemicals, for other substances that are harmful, but they can be controlled by the state. Medicines can be harmful. They have to be on recipe and not just open to over the counter selling. So these are the different fine tuning you could introduce in controlling the use and the abuse of substances. The idea of a prohibition as such, I mean, banning just certain substances is just to abandon them in criminal organization, in criminal hands. We know that, for instance, from the prohibition of alcohol during many years in the United States between the two world wars, where the effect was the strengthening of the mafia, but also bad quality alcohol, but also the disappearance of lighter alcohol beverage towards stronger alcohol, because the benefits for the organization was better. So that there is really a spectrum we have to consider. If a substance is very harmful, it has to disappear from the market. But in favor of substances that are less harmful. But for many of them, they are harmful but can be controlled with a different mix of condition to bring them on the market. So on one side, you have, for instance, the control of tobacco. You know that you cannot sell it to minors. You know that you cannot smoke in public places. You know that the cigarette cannot be too strong. You know perhaps that you cannot make advertising. These are all the means of this fine-tuning to control the supply of substances that are harmful, but they are harmful if they are sold by organization whose interest is not the public health but just the money.
32 countries currently have the death penalty for drug smuggling. 6 countries are known to routinely execute people who smuggle drugs or traffic drugs. They're mostly in Asia and the Middle East as well. Aside from the legacy issue, which you mentioned just now, that plagues Southeast Asia, I'm sure you will face the resistance from socially conservative forces or people who argue from the religious point of view. How do you engage them if they refuse to accept treating drug abuse with more drugs is not acceptable?
Well, the issue of death penalty is on one side an issue of an absolute moral imperative, I would say. For a majority of countries in the world, the right to life is the fundamental human right, and killing people in the name of the state, killing people in the name of the whole society, killing people with cold blood and announcing it in advance is just something that is, in my view, horrible and a negation of the right to life. But if we reduce now the view on the link between drug policy and the death penalty, it is clear for international, for the interpretation of the international law, that even drug trafficking of the highest level doesn't belong to the most severe crimes that are retained as possible reason for death penalty by international law. If you think, for instance, that the International Tribunal for the Penal Court, International Penal Court, who has to judge the most severe crimes, crimes of war, crimes against humanity, genocide, has abandoned the idea of death penalty, you can imagine how shocking it is to think that people can be sentenced to death because they are found, for instance, like here in Malaysia, in possession of a quite little number of substances, of illicit substances. And worse of all, that the judge has no possibility to judge really the situation of these people. He is obliged to give a mandatory death penalty. And you know, in the world, the image of one of the judge here in Malaysia who cried when he had to sentence somebody to death because he knew that it is a terrible thing to do, went through the world and moved many people. So when we think, and I am convinced that policy is a development step by step, and that you generally don't make giant jumps in social issue. So we are also ready to discuss and to discuss with countries where they are just now. And we think it's no worse to have a whole program that is far from what they are living now. So if I think on countries of this region. I mean, first of all, we have to develop harm reduction measures. And Malaysia is a good example for the region with exchange of syringes, with the possibility of methadone treatment. It was a good example, but I think it stopped a little bit in this development with the cure and care movement that is going away from compulsory treatment to voluntary treatment in settings that are open to real reintegration and treatment. But Malaysia, and I am very sorry to tell it, is a bad example because it's one of the countries which not only retains death penalty, but has, I think there are 10 in the world, compulsory, mandatory death penalty with very low threshold. It's also an example, a shocking example of physical punishment in some of these treatment centers or in prisons. So, as I said before, we cannot make a big jump. We cannot say decriminalize everything, legalize, and this is not our message here. Our message here is make these very important steps of abandoning the mandatory death penalty, of abandoning the physical punishment of drug users, and abandoning the idea that with constrained treatment you can help the people.
That was the former president of Switzerland, Ruth Dreyfus. And that's it. There are no shows tomorrow, but we will see you on January 4th, same time, same channel. Happy New Year, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.